Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
We're going old school this week on the Real Guy Podcast. Captain Norm and I visit Merritt Boat Company in Pompano, Florida, to interview the world-famous Eddie Herbert. Eddie started in the 60s at Key Biscayne and has traveled the world with some of the most famous boats that have ever been built. Captain Norm and his father have had history with Eddie, fishing with him for years. So today, sit back and listen to the story from a true legend, Eddie Herbert.
Clear the airwaves. The Lunker Dog is on the air.
Are you ready? This is the Real Guy Podcast.
What years did you fish with Norm?
We had the 54 Merritt.
Yeah, Mike Saragusa's boat.
So that would have been before Hugo. So yeah. I'm thinking it was 88.
88 or 89, something like that.
89 was Hugo.
Yeah.
I don't think you would have been there at 89 because the...
Actually, it was that summer.
Wait a minute.
It was that summer.
Then we lost, yeah.
In fact, I'll tell you how I know it was 89. That was the year I turned 21. And I turned 21 while I was in the pit with Kunta.
It was Kunta and who else?
Pete Sanchez.
Okay.
And
that one day it was so miserable. Yeah. We got out. We fished all day long, raining, miserable. And like at 3:30 in the afternoon, it cleared up. Gorgeous.
Yep.
Between 3 and... dark, yep. Or whatever we fished, and we caught 4.
Yep.
And I've got that picture at home with you doing this stretched out.
No kidding. Oh, wow.
I got it in my album. You don't have that picture?
I might have it somewhere.
I've got to try to get it to you then because...
You can take a picture with your phone and then text it to him. At least
there
I
you
have
go.
It digitally.
Yeah, it's got it's got you stretched out.
Stretched
with
out.
With the leather, just like this.
Yeah.
The fish up in the air.
Yeah, he was standing on his tail. Yeah, I remember that picture.
Yeah.
Kunta thought it was a Marlin magazine cover.
it should have been. It should have been.
It was a great shot.
But, and then, of course, you know, fishing, your dad fished with me in Cozumel and in St. Thomas.
And then, in Palm Beach.
Yeah, and then he also, of course, I ran it in every tournament. He would be there.
Yep.
You know? From when he had the Hatteras to the both Hatterases to ADOC with him, and then he had the brown one, the 50.
Yeah, he had a 37, and then he had a 50, and it was actually that's how
he bought the Scarborough.
Right, and this goes back a long ways. It was probably 1977 or 78. And I think we were out on D Dock at Bahiamar, and on one side of us was the hooker with Skip and Kunta, and on the other side of us was you and maybe Alan on the Elobo.
It was 70, yeah.
Little 36 Elobo, Hatteras.
Yeah.
And you were the first guy, and this was the first time I'd been introduced to Fort Lauderdale and fishing offshore and that kind of thing. And the very first billfish I ever saw was Eddie had caught a blue marlin, and we watched him put it in the boat. And I saw that fish on the dock. And
that was the first Skip.
That was the Skip, you and Skip, but you did it on that 30 on that 36 Hatteras.
Yep, we got a picture of it standing there holding it all up.
Mm-hmm. And that was the first blue marlin I ever saw get caught was right here in Fort Lauderdale.
And your dad would always come around the dock, and that's when he still lived in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
He'd just come down, go fishing, and go home.
So, Eddie, tell us how you ended up in Fort Lauderdale.
I left Key Biscayne. My hope was to stay on the Key, but to try to get a charter boat slip there was... no way. It just wasn't going to happen. Those slips were passed down forever and ever. But I moved up there in 70, I believe it was like 77.
So way back then, what were the premier sport fishing boats back then?
Bertram or Hatteras.
Right.
Well, in the way of production boats, Bertram Ederson, probably Rybovich. Merritt was in the mix too, but Rybovich was building just a shade bit bigger boats that everybody wanted. Merritt was still in the 43 and the 37, which I had. We had a 43
for quite a while. Yeah, my father thought the 37
I think he may even toot a fish with me over there in the 43. And that was the first Merritt. I've run a 37 too, but it's Roy owned one. But the those were the premier, but in the way of boats was Bertram Hatteras.
Oh my God! I remember when the 55 Hatteras first came out, and that was like
the queen of the fleet. Right, if you had the 53, a lot of people had them. But when the 55 came out, Bertram came out with the 54. You remember?
Sure.
That was
Burgess.
My favorite.
Had the Screaming Eagle,
yeah, Screamin' Eagle with Eric.
The 54 to 55, yeah. Those were your, when you went to the custom or the Bertram Hatteras shootout, that was the boat.
Eddie, tell us just a little bit about what it was like in those early days on ADOC.
Well,
and coming
was,
up and how
there was
how
ton
you
of boats. Number one, there was 20, if I remember, they had 24 slips.
Wow. Yeah.
And when I came down there and, you know, talked to them about the lady that ran the dock, I talked to her about moving it, Betty. And then they had a slip available. And pretty much in the peak, every one of them slips was taken. You're talking about a lot of competition, a lot of – and they had – it wasn't like down south. Well, Key Biscayne didn't have a lot of walk-up business to begin with, but, you know, Castaways had a different reputation. Yeah. But, you know, as you know, at Bahia Mar, they kept everything. She did run the dock.
You know, oh, yeah, she
kept
did.
It. Yeah. And you could only book behind your boat. The prices were set. You couldn't discount. You might have been able to charge more. You just couldn't charge any less than what the going rate was. She handled all amounts. You got a whopping 20%. Yeah. And that meant myself or whoever the deckhand was would get 10%. And then Bahia Mar got 5, and then she got 5.
Wow. Wow. And now what were the first boats that you were running?
We brought that Hatteras in there, and then we exchanged it for that 46 Bertram. And we had that there for quite a while.
Okay.
And then when we bought that 43 Merritt, I just got talked into moving up to Fish City. And back then, that's what it was called.
I don't know.
Inlet Marina now, whatever they call it.
Right.
But we moved up there. We took the 43 up there. We had a 43 Merritt up there.
That's right.
And we actually took that boat to Texas and fished it. And we chartered out of there for quite a while. Then finally, it just wasn't. We were doing so much traveling, there was no point chartering anymore.
Right. Now, this was El Lobo
The first one was El Lobo.
That was El Lobo.
Second one was Grand Slam, which was a 46 Bertram. And the third one was a bootlegger.
Eddie's been able to keep some very good relationships through the sport fishing world, and has surrounded himself with top-notch guys like Skip Smith.
Now, tell us just a little bit, because you and Skip kind of mirrored each other in terms of coming up from ADOC, and you and Skip.
That's how I met Skip.
Right.
His dad, of course, owned the drift boat, and he was working on a yacht over there, and he was running their little game boat. I think it was like a 28 carry at the time, or 32 carry, something like that. And that's where we sort of met. And I was really fortunate when the one Bob that was fishing as my deckhand, he was becoming an attorney. He was going to law school. So he was going to leave sooner or later. So he left, and then Skip came on board.
Now, coming up from ADOC is really where you cut your teeth on, and tell us a little bit more about how you matriculated up from there to, you know, traveling all over the Bahamas and everything else like that.
Well, at ADOC, because we did so well, we got a really, really good clientele.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, having Skip with me, and the clientele just kept growing and growing, and one of the charters we had, and I think this would have been like 1979, he had a 46 Hatteras. He was a Texan. And he went out with us that day. We took him and some friends out. And he says, well, my boat's coming over from Texas. I'm going to have it up there at whatever it was at the time, Cable Marine or Bradford's or whatever. And he says, I'm going to take it to Cozumel, and I need somebody. I'm thinking, whoa, I really, this is the opportunity. Yeah. Because you'd heard the rumors of the striker fleets that would do those rendezvous down in Cozumel and see these fantastic numbers. And I said, man, this is a dream. And I was still in my really early 20s, so it was like, whoa, I want to take this opportunity. He says, well, we'll go to Cozumel, then we'll go to Texas and fish all the tournaments over there. I go, man, this is something I don't want to pass up. I went and talked to the owner of the El Lobo, and he says, look, I did it for you, because I had been working for him for so many years as a mechanic. And when he had all the Mercury dealerships, he said, you know what, it doesn't mean nothing to me. He says, bring the boat back up here. And then I took the job, and we went to Cozumel, came back, fished Cuba.
Oh, wow.
Which was really rare. They had that first Hemingway. I think there were 75 boats.
My father was in on that.
Bobby was.
Yep.
A lot of guys were there. And then from there, we went to Texas. And that's when Kunta jumped on with me. And
this Siragusa?
No, this was one guy before that. And the name of the boat was the Larissa. It was just 46 hatters, pretty plain. And when we were up over there, we flew Skip in to fish all the tournaments. So it's me, Kunta, and Skip. Couldn't have been a better combination. We fished Poco.
Deadly tournament.
And the next year, Kunta had hooked up with the guys from the Hooker. And brought, well, I take it back. Now, they didn't bring in Skip in on that one. They did bring Skip in, but they chartered a boat. And they ended up, I can't remember what they did. But the next year, they had the Hooker there, and they won it.
Okay.
Him, Kunta, and Peter Wright.
Right. Yeah.
And then we kept going back, and then the next year while I was there, I met Siragusa and sort of put that deal together, and that went on for till 1990.
Yeah, you were with him a good long while.
Yeah, almost 10 years.
Now, I want to backtrack just a little bit on your tournament, your tournaments. Now, if you were in the Triple Crown, if you were fishing the sailfish tournaments, if you were doing that circuit in the 1980s, and you heard that Eddie Herbert was running a boat in this tournament, you started quaking in your boots.
Well, we would
tell us about that.
The Fort Lauderdale Billfish tournament, that was a big deal. You know, we all were there for that, and there weren't the tournaments there are now, and nowhere near the money, and nowhere really the competition. So what we would do is, you know, back then, Skip, and this is not, Skip pretty much was the one that came up with the two kite idea. Nobody was flying two kites. I mean, nobody was doing that. Skip sort of figured out the way to make the kite fly, and then it was caught on. John Dudas Sr. caught on right after Skip did. And we started doing it. Of course, we only did four baits instead of now they're doing six.
Right.
Some guys may be doing more. And we started doing that, but fishing the Lauderdale Billfish tournament, and you went out with the kite. And you fish four mullet in the kite. And I remember the first year we won it down there off
John Tedder Specials.
And then somebody had run. The guy had that hardware store in Lauderdale. He had a 26 strike, the fiberglass one.
Mr. Withall?
What is it?
Was it Larry Withall? Larry's dad?
That sounds familiar. That's him. And they ran to Bemini and caught a blue marlin. But we had enough sailfish. I forgot what we had. Alan was with me.
Right.
I forget what we had, but we did it on points. But, you know, that 23 Seacraft, the couple that owned the tackle store, they would win that thing very. Remember we had two Lauderdale tournaments a year. You had in April and October.
Sure, yeah.
We were never there for the April one because we were in Cozumel or Texas or the Bahamas.
I want to talk about those old tournaments in Fort Lauderdale because, like, right now, I mean, you've probably seen it, Eddie. It's kind of, we're losing the identity of downtown, where it used to be a fishy place, and the tournaments were grandiose, and everybody from the world came here. And now, yeah, they come here, but they come here to see a Merit, or a mega yacht, or to stay at the W Hotel.
Or to go to the Hard Rock Casino.
Right. It's not the fishing destination. You lived through it. When
charter
it was
boats dock is gone, basically, just like Castaways disappeared.
Yeah, it's gone.
Pier 5 disappeared years ago. Now, of course, there is a Pier 5, but it's not the old Pier 5. And BMR's gone.
Yeah.
And it's shrunk. It went from 24 to 15 to 12 to 10 to 8. And, you know, look at some of the guys that have been there for, like Rick, they've been there forever. He just sold out and got out. You know, and he had two boats. At one time, three. And now there's what, one charter dock down there by the
they're scattered Las throughout Solis. There.
They're little ones, but it's not the big charter dock that had been at Bahia Mar for years. I mean, there was like Jack Whittemore and the Stairs guys, all them guys, Pee Wee, they were all there for years. And that there's more history coming out of that dock.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, there used to even be a Fort Lauderdale Blue Marlin tournament at one time. I guess that was in the 60s. But the dock, it's what progress has done, right. You know? It's more valuable as something else. It's not valuable as a fishing community. It's better off as whatever, a condo.
Now, was that your fondest era back then in the 80s and early 90s?
That charter boat dock was pretty cool, but when we really, traveling, I mean, we'd sit there in the late 60s, 70s to go to a trip to the Bahamas. Oh, man. We'd plan for a week to go to Bemidji. We'd plan for a month to go to Chubb. Now you go to Bemidji, 20-minute notice, and Chubb.
Oh,
Bahamas, we didn't have the range. You didn't have the boats. You didn't have it to do what we do today.
Yeah.
I mean, to sit there and do a 1,500-mile trip on its own bottom, we didn't have that ability. We didn't have GPS. We didn't have fancy radars and sonars and everything that we have today. Mm-hmm. So it's so much more... technical now than it was back then. You had to live on instincts.
Right. My dad thought that was the greatest era in fishing, because as people learned to travel more and to reach out, that everybody kind of needed everybody else in order to make it happen. So it was a community.
No, now if you don't have a sonar, don't fish. Now, in tournaments now, they have two divisions, sonar, no sonar.
Really?
I mean, we just, example, just a month ago in Mags Bay, there were three of us left up there. And we're talking a huge, massive area to cover.
Right.
And we found, you can see the floppers and the jumpers and, sort of what the bait balls, but there were three of us up there, two of us had sonars. We each had 65 fish each. Or in the 60s, 70s. Actually, one boat may have a few more. And the one boat without a sonar had 9.
Right. Right.
So look at the difference.
Yeah.
So, and the old depth finder just doesn't do the trick anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now,
that's amazing.
Who introduced you to the offshore bill fishing?
Poof. Goes really, really back. Believe it or not, it was Jim Lambert, who I worked for a lot of years, his father. Jim Sr., let me see if I get this right, his brother-in-law, Harry Tellum, lived on Key Biscayne, had a 35 Bertram, and he took me for my first sailfish when I was about 9 or 10 years old. I was always hanging around the dock behind his boat there, and I had a little John boat with a 3-horsepower or 6-horsepower Johnson on it. I got a Boston Whaler, and then I got a 23 Sea Craft, and it went on from there, but he says, "Come on, boy, let's go. Go ask your parents. Okay, you go fish." He took out. We caught a sailfish, and it was just never.
That was it.
Never looked back. And then, of course, not knowing that Jim Lambert was his brother-in-law, and when I finally went to work for Jim in '95, Jim came down in St. Thomas and fished with me on the Bootlegger in '83, and that's when I met him and realized it was Harry Tellum. And that I grew up with all the Tellum boys. We're all from the Keys, so growing up there. But Harry probably was the one that was most getting me into offshore fishing.
Nice.
But catching me that fish cost me a lot of money. I started spending money like it was water to go offshore fishing.
And that's the funny thing about it, too, is this: you can almost always point to one guy and one fish that started it all for you. And the funny part about it is, Eddie, you and that Blue Marlin in 1978 was what started it for me. Okay, seeing that. And, I've actually taken it now. Jeff and I are kind of trying to bring back the Blue Marlin fishing thing right here in Fort Lauderdale, and we've been trying to do it here.
We tried it a few times. Yeah. With Jim, when we got bored, he got bored, and, there was nothing else going on. We would go out there to where the swordfish grounds are and put your lures out. We actually tried it one time at the Pompano Rodeo, because remember that? There was a time in the rodeo, people were all running to the Bahamas catching blue marlin, then it got all big, out of control, and everybody got up in arms. Yep, he was one.
I think he won it one time. He did win it. Yeah.
And, of course, that caused a big turmoil. And so then they said, "Well, now you got to stay within the, So we actually went out and tried it. And by God, I did think we had a bite. And we went out with Jim for a couple days in a row, and I think we had a bite too.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, one of the things that we've been talking with the audience about since we started the podcast about 5 years ago is how guys like yourself and my dad, you know, Blue Marlin or Billfish was priority. Everything else was kind of like bycatch in the amount of fish that you could catch off of Fort Lauderdale. So I got a 31 Bertram about 12, 14 years ago. First thing I wanted to do was catch a blue marlin off the coast of Fort Lauderdale, and we were able to make it happen. Then Norm and I start telling old stories about Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah.
Norm gets...
I got the bug.
He got the hair up his ass. He goes out there. He's raising fish.
Yeah. We caught one last year.
Another friend of ours, because of the podcast, was into it. He went out there. He was catching fish. And it's just hard to watch the masses go after blackfin tunas and small dolphin when you know that those fish are sitting there.
Years ago, too, and I know now from fishing on Miami, or even when I go fishing with my own boat at Stewart, I got the 30 contender, but I will not go on a weekday, a weekend. Mm-hmm. I always try to go on a weekend. The boat ramp is like nothing you've ever seen. So back up pressure. I mean, fishing Miami's a kid. You'd be out there with a kite up. There might be half a dozen boats all on a weekend with a kite up, and that's it. Now there's hundreds.
Oh, yeah.
And you're sort of thinking, you're like, how's it poor selfish even have a chance to get through all these live baits? But it's they're out there. There was a, growing up, there was a guy who worked for a radio station that had like a little 172 Cessna. It was called the Flying Fisherman. And I believe the guy was Australian. It was like WQAM or WFUN, one of these really old AM radio stations. And he was called the Flying Fisherman. And he would go up every Saturday, and I believe it was Sunday morning, too. And we're talking in the early 70s, and he would fly around everywhere, and he'd fly over you, and you could hold up your fish, whatever, and he'd give a report. He said, there's a weed line 5 miles off Fowey Light, and we see everyone catching dolphin, and we see this and that. And very few people even were kite fishing back then. I mean, more people were just trolling.
Well, and my father told me a story, and I don't know if this is true or not, but he told me that you were one of the first guys to bring kite fishing to Palm Beach.
Well, we went up to fish that tournament, one of the ones, IBL or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Very few boats flew the kite, if not anything. And, I mean, it worked so well in Miami. Well, when we moved to the charter dock in Hillsborough, now, wait a minute, we only moved 11 miles up the beach, so... We live ballyhoos. I just couldn't get into the live ballyhoos. Not that they don't work. I just couldn't. I was so focused on the kite and it brought up kite fishing. We flew the kite and we did very well.
I understand you guys upset a lot of them old boys up there that were still dragging fine. Bullets around.
We're ballyhoos. But yep. Palm Beach, they pulled the goggle eyes out of the riggers.
Right.
Well, the presentation's not there.
Yeah.
So it's so much a better presentation of the kite. And back then, if you had goggle eyes, now if you fish a tournament, you've got to have pilchards. You've got to have sardines. You've got to have threadfish. You've got to have goggle eyes. You've got to have Tinkerback. You've got to have it all. If you go out and just goggle eyes, it's like you're going out in the woods and you're hunting everything, but with only a .22. You know, you're not going to shoot a moose with a .22, but you got to have everything. And years ago, we were happy with mullet or pinfish. Now that's unheard of. You wouldn't hear anybody be, everybody's got to have goggle eyes, thread fins. You know that going for bait guys. Oh, yeah. If they don't have blue runners, I don't want them.
the pinfish days.
The lowly pinfish.
Remember that? Was it Harbor Beach Bait, Harbor Tackle down there?
Bait and Tackle, and then Harbor Bait and Tackle over there. What was that guy's name? Beach Bait and Tackle, and then there was Harbor Bait and Tackle.
Right, yeah.
And they had the live well.
The different wells.
And full of pinfish. Yeah. I tell people those stories that people would put the pinfish on the kites, and they don't believe me for a second. I'm like, I swear to God, people use pinfish on the kites.
We used them all the time.
Sure.
Now, when Skip came to work with me, he goes, hey, we got to have a big well. And his friend, best friend, Craig, had working on the Happy Day. They had one made. I think it was like 40-inch. Well, we can't get no 40-inch in that little ladder, so we put a 36. And fishing live bonitas were incredible.
We did that.
And the guys that would fish them would go out with bonita lines. You catch them and put them out.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to leave the rest of them just hanging on the...
This is before tuna tubes the bonita came live.
Yeah. You know, so we'd throw them flippers in the well. We'd go out. Bonitas in the well, we'd go out and fish a half a day, come in. The well, bonitas were still doing that Then if sailfish was no good, we'd go down to that Hollywood sewer or up there off the Birch State Park in their shallow and put them bonitas out, put a second, you know, get rid of the motto, go to wire, and, I mean, we'd be catching 30, 40, 50-pound barracudas all day long, and people were loving it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's shark fishing, of course, with a live bonita, and, I mean, with Skip, you could almost, it was just like going out. He was always trying something different. If something wasn't working, he would go into trying something different. So,
you know, one of the things that always struck me about you is the level of innovation in fishing that I saw in you. And I do best by example. I remember we were on the Bootlegger, we were on the North Drop, and we had decided we were going to try and catch, we were going to live bait one day. So we got a few tunas. I think they were skipjacks. They might have been little black
ones. And we caught it, if I remember right, I think we found a board with, believe it or not, and you very rarely see this on the North Drop in 30 some odd years, I've hardly ever seen it, but there were some dolphin on it. We caught a couple little dolphin and tried. It really overcast the day, rainy all morning long, miserable.
Well, so one thing that I remember seeing about that that stuck in my mind was when we got the bite, you'd have the angler in the chair. Kota was sitting on the covering board with a big long loop of line in his hand, and the line was just in his forefinger like an outrigger clip. And when you get the bite, it would take it right out of his hand, and then Eddie would back the boat down with the reel in free spool. While they were free spooling the fish, feeding the fish, and I remember watching this like it happened yesterday, and then he'd yell, "All right, go ahead, let's try him." The angler would push the reel drag up into the strike position, and Eddie shot the boat ahead, and the fish stood up on his tail, and he was hooked right there. And I mean, like, you could see what color that fish's eyes were. He was that close to you.
Learned that in Australia. When they live bait in Australia, that's how they did it. It worked. Now, you can't live bait in St. Thomas at all. It just won't work.
Really?
The sharks are too bad.
The sharks, can't.
You couldn't. You could have thrown bait over the side, it would even disappear out of sight. Shark could have it. But we did catch a few, and we actually tried kite fishing down there, too.
Really?
Trouble was getting the bait. We wanted the big blue runners.
Yeah.
And we spent half a day getting bait. But we did catch it. We had a couple bites on the kite, too, which were pretty cool. But just to try something different.
And I think that's the thing that so many guys don't realize is that it was guys like Eddie that started these things and took, you know, the level of innovation. And these are the stories that we don't see anymore. You know, all these kids these days, they go out there, they got the GPS, they didn't have that.
Use that or innovation to try something different. Like sail fishing. In the tournaments, we use 80-pound leader. Now, that's unheard of. We didn't have fluoro. There was no such thing as that. So, and then we dropped down to 60, and man, we can't go any less than that. Now you're using, if you're using 30. over 30 or 40, it's too heavy. Yeah. Spinning rods are 30, and of course, the fluoro is much, you know, much improved the sport, but I mean, we didn't have that ability. So, and even though when you were, sometimes you're fishing 50s. Right. You wouldn't even put a leader, just straight 50.
Just straight 50.
Trouble is it wind. It's spin up on you, but you would do that too.
And now, so tell us, what are you doing these days now?
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
In other words,
where have you been the last few years?
Well, the last 3 years I've been in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico. So we just got back. We unloaded the boat off the well. We were going to have, they're having all the issues in Panama, of course. No water in the canal. Right, we were going to have to come back on our own bottom. A good friend of mine, Bobby Brown, another Hawaiian captain, been around forever. He was going to make a trip back with me, hired two other local guys that were actually coming to work for me anyway. Plus, I was going to keep my two Mexican mates that have been fishing with me over there, and we're just going to bring the boat back its own bottom. It's just been on a long trip. We'd probably still be, who knows, in Cologne waiting to come up. Trouble is getting up the Pacific, Atlantic side this time of year, the wind.
Look what we've been dealing with weather here. Yeah,
can't get a break. But we got real fortunate our last day, a couple last days of fishing. We got a call. One ship was going to evidently bought the extortion money to go through the canal, paid up, and of course it cost us more. And I said to my boss, I said, "What do you want to do? You want to? We'll keep go. We'll do keep our plan, or you want to just put it on the ship?"
Yeah.
We loaded December 25th in La Paz, and then we unloaded when you took me out to get the boat on December 7th or January 7th.
Tell us a little bit about that that fishing out there.
Pretty incredible. I had the opportunity to go. We discussed it for years. That's a big deal to get over there with this boat. And, you know, we got fortunate. We were invited to come over fish on the real wheels.
Right.
And we went over there, myself and my boss and Roy and Jim. And it was just unbelievable. We couldn't believe what we were seeing. And on the plane ride home, Jim said, "Get it ready. We're going."
So, and what were you seeing?
Well, it's just the amount of fish. It's just like, how can there be this many fish in one area? And the first year we got there, every year, all 3 years were somewhat different. Now, the first 2 years were pretty much the same. This year, really, I'm not going to say off. It was just we weren't seeing what we saw the past 2 years. The big, huge balls of sardines. Mm-hmm. And they were there this year, but in really tiny balls. Now, we're putting big balls of tinker mackerels and stuff, and the fish were not in the bay. We spent one night in Max Bay. We spent a handful of nights down below. There's an anchorage at the bottom of the bay called Tosca. It's an okay anchorage. It's not great, but it's better than nothing. But what I prefer to do, and there's another boat that does it there too, we just don't go in. You got the sea keepers down.
Right.
We get done at the end of the day. You know, you're sitting in the right spot. You throw the sea anchor out, turn the sea keepers on, go down, have dinner. And usually the weather is nice enough to do that. Because, you know, in the middle of the night, sometimes the wind breezes up. But we would just stay out.
Right.
But this, the first year up there, I think our best day, we had a few days over 100. We were still learning the tricks, but we averaged day was 50 to 60 fish. The next year we went, we'd approve, we had 8 days over our 100, and our best day being 182. So you can imagine the quantity of fish. It's incredible the amount of fish that are here. Now, this year, we saw something we never saw before with mahis. And when I mean mahis, there is no way I can describe how bad they were.
How bad they were.
They were, you could not. First of all, we couldn't fish any baits, which really hampers your ability to fish correctly. You know, so you got to pull four teasers, and then just trying. Here comes the striped marlin coming in. You pitch to him, pitch the ballyhoo to him, and dolphin beat the marlin.
No kidding.
And the amount of just Dorados and sea lions were just worse than we had ever seen them the 2 years before.
You had a
before.
Lot of fur bags up there, huh?
Yeah, oh, millions of them. They're all over. In the middle of the night, they're all behind a boat.
Barking at you.
Barking at you. And this year was different from the past 2 years. It just was. The fish were there, and they're still there. I think one boat yesterday had 25 or so, but we did not see the baits, and the fish were all down below us. Nothing. Like I said, I spent one night at Mag's Bag.
Right.
For the years before, we were up there for dozens of nights. And, again, we just started not going in. Just shut the motors up. Now, if it's breezy, you want to go in. But if it's nice, just throw the sea anchor out, turn your gyros on, go down there, cook dinner, and you go to bed.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. What an experience.
Yeah. you've been doing this for so long. And, I mean, you dedicated your life to...
Yeah, I did. I got caught up in it when I was so... Harry Tallop caught that first... It was all over then. And I think my father would prefer I had followed in his footsteps. He did. 33 years in the military. I think he was Hope Navy. And I think I almost went to Coast Guard. Really close. I went, took the exam. And I really sort of wanted to do that. And it was close. I literally, all I had to do was show up. Last minute, I got cold feet. But I just couldn't.
All the years that you put in, was there a specific dream team that you fish with?
I've been so fortunate to have so many guys, and everybody says fishing is definitely a team sport.
Oh yeah,
because for a good captain to be good, you got to have a good crew.
Absolutely,
you can have the best captain in the world if you don't have good guys down below. It doesn't work. I've been very blessed with some really really good guys. Of course, Skip being one of the best because of just the way he could see things out in him, and he would discuss it with you. We talk about it and then do it. And then, of course, Alan was another one he liked.
Oh,
and then,
boy.
Of course, I've had a bunch of good guys. Well, I've been really, really fortunate my whole career.
You had Kunta and you had Fly.
I had Kunta and Skip. Now, on the real tight,
yeah.
I had that same team for the whole time Jim was with.
Wow.
I had Fly, Joe Fiegel, and Eric Leach. His dad's IGFA, or was. And that team, we were hung together the whole time. And it was like, but Jim fished, we fished 200 plus days a year. I don't mean traveling, fishing. We still had to get where he wanted to go, Panama, Costa Rica. He fell in love pretty much with St. Thomas. We did Venezuela when you could go, but he fell in love with St. Thomas. And I think if it was up to him, we tried 1 year to stay year round. We just couldn't fish. December, January, February is unfishable.
Yeah.
So we ended up turning. I think we went to a friend of his that told him about Dominican Republic. So we tried that. It was good. More big blue marlins, but there was a pretty good quality of them. But I think that team, because we held together for such a long time, everybody was good. Fly was so good at we'd come in for somewhere, especially if it was in Panama, Costa Rica, Venezuela. He'd be out there with that native tongue of his, speaking the Spanish, get everything done. He'd head off to the grocery store, go into town, do all the shopping. Joe was absolutely meticulously with the tackle. He maintained all the tackles. So that way, if there's a failure, not everybody's doing this, pointing fingers at each other. Joe did everything, and we never had a tackle failure. And, we tried some experimenting. With different hook sets, trying to, improve on the hookup ratio. And then, of course, Eric, when it came to fishing, he was just, the kid had gills.
I'm so glad you brought up Eric, because our goal with the Real Guy podcast is for people to hear people like yourself, people like Eric. Now, Skip has a little bit more coverage than most, but that's the real guy. You know what I mean? That's the guy that's doing the nuts and bolts. And I take a little pride because we've had Skip on here. We've had Eric on the podcast. And now having you.
Well, Skip's done things that no one person has done. I mean, to all the places he went with the madam, Australia and Cape Verde and Senegal and all the places they were. I don't know of anybody that I know in this industry. Of course, things have improved now. There's a lot of boats in Cape Verde. The guys put them on the ship, but Skip did it on his own bottom.
On his own bottom.
He went the hard way. He didn't just get to fly in a jet and land and go fishing.
And there wasn't GPS.
And there wasn't any of that stuff. Skip had to do it all his own. Of course, all the rural records he's got will probably never be beaten. But Skip probably saw more than any of us combined will ever see.
Oh, so one thing that struck me about you is, you know, and I want to point this out that there's so many 30-year-old super captains that are out there now today. And the one thing that I don't think that I think it's been lost on a lot of boats and a lot of programs is the captains going into the engine room. I have not seen a captain that spends more time in the engine room than you.
Well, that's when I got lucky. When I started really getting to more fancy boats back then, we were in fishing clubs in Miami. So I had a Capri and an old Boston Whaler, but my first boat was a 23 Seacraft. That thing, I mean, I was anybody in the clubs, you either had a Cuda craft, you had a Speedcraft or a Seacraft. And there were guys that had other stuff, but I ended up getting a Speedcraft later on. But we had that, I had a 23 Seacraft. Boy, we'd go to Bimini, and I mean, it was just like the queen of the fleet back then.
Yeah.
But you know, I thought, man, I gotta own these things. I better figure out how to work on them. So I went to work after school. I'd go down and, you know, the boat center down there, it was called, what was it called back then? Well, it was called Boat Center, but it was something before that. But and I started rigging boats. They put me rigging boats, and then they sort of moved me up, and then moved me into being a mechanic, and then they moved me to the North Miami store, and then I was a mechanic. So learning it, and then, of course, when I was with the bootlegger, I went to the schools. I went to the advanced one. I did Onan. I did, Detroit Diesel, and we even did Cummins because we had Cummins in the other one, and I know Skip did some of them too. There are places you can't just pick up the phone and call a mechanic,
and that's just
you got to fix it yourself, or you're not going fishing.
And that's the thing that so many of these young guys don't get anymore, and that is they don't want to take the time to learn these things. My kid's 19 years old, and he's just starting to work on boats now. And I told him, I said, listen, here's what I want you to do. I want you to get a year or so of experience, and then I want you to start going to these schools because I want you to come up the way that the old school guys did, and because that's where your real value is going to be, and I think that's one of the reasons.
You gotta remember, as a charter boat,
yeah,
I was fortunate. I had someone else paying the majority of the real bad bills.
Mm-hmm.
But as a charter boat, especially someone like the Marlon Darling, Ruin Rick, you've got to be able to fix it yourself. You can't afford to pick up the phone.
No.
You know, even with the back then, the VHFs and the radios, you could plug and play, you know, different, pull this out, put this in. Now you can't do that. It's all, you just throw the stuff away and buy new stuff. But charter boats, if you had a charter the next morning and you had dropped an injector that day, you better have that injector and be able to put that new one in that night to not miss that charter the next morning.
I heard a story about you doing that kind of thing. You and Skip tearing engines down the night before.
Well, I do. I've actually done it. Some of the guys up, you know, other captains. We'd go over, or I'd go over after we got in for fishing, and what's the problem? Well, it's smoking, white smoke. Well, it's probably an injector. If it's not blue, we go in there, and back then you put the screwdriver in there and shorted the injector out by jamming the plunger down. And, okay, that's the one. You got an M90 injector or an M70, whatever it is. Yeah, I do have one. Okay, let's put it in, and he'd be fishing. You know, a lot of guys on ADOC had did that too because I got to know the Detroit Diesels, and they were easy.
And Jeff, is there any wonder why the best have come up from docks like ADOC? Yeah. There it is, right there.
Yeah, when they took ADOC down the year before last, one of the things that we were trying to emphasize and trying to get the world to realize is that ADOC was like Sport Fish University.
For Fort Lauderdale, yeah, like as of maybe Bud Mary's or Chesapeake Dock or, Crandon Park. You know, look at all the great guys off Crandon Park and good fishermen, you know, out of Key Biscayne. And unfortunately now property is more valuable than, you know, fishing. yeah. when it comes to this. And, of course, BMR, right in the middle of downtown Fort Lauderdale, that wasn't going to happen.
Right.
This property's too valuable.
Yeah, yeah, big time, well, including the property we're sitting
well,
on
look,
now.
Even it's really fortunate that some of the better docks, like Sailfish Marina, some of the 4G people have bought them that want to keep everything fishing.
They want to keep the
rather than just turn it into a money making marina. They've kept the charter docks, kept it because of the owners. You know, there's not all, it's all about making money,
right.
keeping the marina like it was.
Right.
Versus a lot of these marinas, just hey, why should we give a charter boat, you know, paying $500 or $600 or $800 or $1,000 a month when we can get a guy in there that'll pay us $6,000 or $8,000?
Right.
So it's all money.
All money.
The fishing part of it now is gone. You know, by the way, and of course, charter fishing these days, now with the prices of fuel.
Oh.
When I first started doing it, it was 16 cents a gallon for diesel fuel.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when it got to a dollar, we were complaining.
It's a thousand.
A dollar a gallon.
It's $1,000 for a half-day trip in the Keys now.
If I remember right, what was it when I first got to ADOC? I'm thinking $150 a day. Half a day. $300 for all the two. I can't remember. But I remember around $200 for half a day. And then clearly going up from there. But, yeah. I mean, even in Cabo, we paid $6 a gallon. Devaluation didn't help. Because right now, when we got there, it's 22 pesos to the dollar. Now it's 15.5.
Yeah.
So and there's plenty of fuel. It's not the fuel shortage. It's just there's a devaluation, but really the same way here. The price of fuel, your tackle, your line, and then you got to pay your crew more.
Yeah.
And
I'm paying $100 a week to use the boat ramp.
Is that what they're getting now? 4G hasn't gone that way in Stewart yet, but I know here in, across from the boatyard here, they charge, I think you go in and put your, I don't know, $5-$10 to launch your boat.
I'll think about it. So I put in at Hollywood last night.
Mm-hmm.
It's $20.
You Martin County ain't got there yet, but I don't see any other way that's going to happen. They've got to do something. Now, if you go down to Palm Beach County, they wanted you originally to buy a sticker. Now they got the machine.
Right.
So, but you know, I used to buy that. I didn't put in much down there, but Martin County so far, they're all on the, you know, no charge yet, but I would suspect sooner or later it's going to happen.
Well, I don't want to end this podcast by bitching about how expensive everything is.
No, we're just saying where things have gone.
Oh, yeah.
Touching on what he said, basically it's putting the charter boat guys out of business.
Oh yeah. And but let me ask you, let me just switch gears just a little bit. What do you see for the future of sport fishing in general? What are the hot new markets? What are the hot new destinations? Do you see a change
destination wise? Everybody's, you know, we got of course Cape Verde, and of course you can put on a ship, and you know it's expensive, but you know, put the boat on a ship, send it over, then you got to be able to get there. Mm-hmm. It's difficult unless you've got the ability to fly direct right from here to Cape Verde. Some people can. And I think we're going to hold tight. I know St. Thomas has dropped off a little bit. A lot of places have, but and they come and go. We have hot spurts.
Right.
1 year could be, you know, really good. And I think there's a lot of other places that have not been found.
Well, that's kind of where and I was
it's,
going.
It's, but you got to get people that are willing. That's where Skip found out with the Madam and Hooker. He had the ability to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, here you're in St. Thomas. Do you really want to go down and try Grenada or Barbados fishing when you know you're catching three or four nice bites a day, or Bermuda, where you might be, to go place that's unknown? And number, here's another problem. One boat doesn't do it. If you went up, when we first started fishing in Mag Bay, we were one of the first boats up there. That's a huge area. You're talking three areas over probably 60 miles that you're trying to cover, maybe more. One boat, we could miss them by 10 miles.
Right.
With other boats, they'll know. But here, people don't want to leave that great area to go experiment. There's probably, you look at the Caribbean, there's got to be more blue marlin spots like St. Thomas. That is not the only blue. They don't all come. I look at the Dominican Republic. I don't believe when they start putting all the fads here, you know, blue marlin starts showing. There's spots. And now we have the ability to do that with these bigger boats with more fuel, the technology, but you just got to bite the bullet and go try it.
Right. Talking about boats, let's talk about your relationship with Roy over here at Merritt's. Now,
we started with a 43, and then we got a 54. That didn't end well. It ended up in a storm.
Oh, God, I remember
But believe
that.
It or not, the boat is still with us. That boat has been the guy down there in Miami, that Glass Tech, fixed that whole boat up. And I don't know how. There was a hole in the bottom that's big enough to walk through. He fixed that boat up. It's still running around today. And I've had, I built a 65-footer. I built an 80-footer. I built a 72-footer. And those were from scratch. And then I had a 58 and another 65 on top of the one I built, the second, which Lambert had. And we've had a lot of merits. And I've run probably almost everything he's built. Wow. 37, which he had, 46, and, of course, the 54s and the 58s. But
So walk me through how this would work. All right, so you go out and do the fishing. You come back. You speak with Merritt, Roy, I guess. And you would, what, give suggestions? You'd have a list of things that you needed to accomplish? How would it work?
He's from a fishing family, too, especially his father. You know, Alan was what it probably involved with a group of the best tuna fishermen there were at the time. Of course, the tunas were there to catch. But, you know, he was with the Sterises and the amount of people. He's from a fishing family. And, of course, his grandfather, they fished. His dad fished for a living in Fort Lauderdale when the charter boat dock was up the river.
Yep.
And he was born, you know, that's how he made his money. Roy told me growing up he was so sick of a piece of kingfish, that's all his dad would. They didn't have money to buy food, so they would just, you know, get kingfish and whatever they could catch. What about Dorado? They wouldn't eat them. They wouldn't all eat kingfish, but actually, probably Dorado was worth too much money to sell. But we need to, the scuppers are this big, and we really need to make them this big. Well, let's talk about this. And next thing you know, they're this big.
Yeah.
And, well, they're only that big, and the other, no, now they're getting bigger. And the transom doors, instead of just a door that opens up, now the whole door, so you got a whole. What brought that on is diving. He got into diving.
Really?
Real, real big. We all were. Myself, Roy, and we were, I mean, every other weekend, we'd be going over to Bimini or diving out here. He was big time into diving in the 80s, early 90s. And he actually liked this door so much, he took his family boat, the Caliban, which was a marine management, and put that door in it. Because we'd go over with that boat to Bimini and go diving. Next thing you know, every boat he builds has that same door. And now I look at all the manufacturers, they're all doing it. It's that Hatteras actually probably was one of the first, because remember they would flip up and then out. So you had a direct entrance. So like everybody had it where you're trying to pull it through a door. Hatteras had it, you flipped it open and you had a nice exit. And Roy started doing that. Now every door is like, the whole door just opens up. And I think everybody's going, I don't know if anybody even builds a tuna doors the old-fashioned way.
Not that I know. I haven't seen one in a while. You'd have to custom order.
His dad started fishing out here, some of the things they would try. Of course, today we would say, boy, that's primitive as heck. But it was very modern, you know, fishing with the line and the baits they use and the outriggers. Mm-hmm. That was the thing. Nobody hardly knew what an outrigger was. Right. So, but his family's from fishing, so he's picked up on some of these ideas. But he's worked with numerous good captains that have built boats with him that have brought these ideas. And at first, I'm not too sure I like this, but then it does it. And, hey, you know what? Pretty good idea.
Yeah, yeah. Now, if somebody dropped a big bag of cash in my lap and I went to Roy and I said, hey, Roy, would you build a 37? Would he do it?
He would probably do it, but he's done that for other people.
Yeah.
But he's going to issue one warning. You're probably going to have a 37-foot boat that's going to cost $5 million. You can't. It's the it's so labor-intensive. I asked him, Roy, why don't you build a 43? It was the hottest thing out there when it come to, you know, local fishing. It costs too much to build. You know, they've built these game fishers down here in Costa Rica and stuff where they can do it.
Right.
But here, money-wise, the time and labor. And then if you're even going to build a mold, and a mold, it just takes so much time and labor to do it. You can build these big boats and do it right and have...
The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
It's hour-wise you can get your better bang for your buck. Right. He would probably do it, but you wouldn't want to know what it cost. Right. Well, even though you've got a lot of good builders here in South Florida. Really, of course, you've got the Carolina guys, but you know, you got Mark Willis and you got John Vance, and you got these guys are building really still custom boats, and they do a really good job. And those guys would build you a smaller. I think you'd be better off going with them with the smaller boat. And he would do what he did. Mark built that boat here. What's it called? I think it's a 37, like an open boat. It runs around Lighthouse Point here. I don't remember the name.
Uno Mas?
No.
Maybe?
No, it's like a 32 or 33.
I've seen it.
It's gray looking. It's, I can't think of the name.
Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful boat.
Yeah,
but
I've seen it.
Again, it's the time. It's so labor intensive. Our sport has gotten, it's always been expensive. Always, from day one. But now it's not only expensive, it's mega expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the price of the boat at $8, $10, $12 million, you know, then to maintain it. Buying it's cheap. I mean, I know what we do. I've got, you know, the three crew and then, you know, the insurance, fuel. So years ago when you would get the a little bit better than average person be able to afford a boat like we have today, They can't afford it. Although the CVs contenders and Sea Hunters, whatever. Yeah, even the 39, they're all going to be a million plus.
Right.
And it's, I don't know. The only thing you do is, if you get a good job with a good owner, you've got to do everything you possibly can to try to help. Save a couple bucks. It doesn't matter. They could be Elon Musk, have all the money in the world. You need to, you want to try to do it as economically as you can, but yet don't let the boat suffer. Like our boat is maintained with an open checkbook.
Yeah.
But like there's something I wanted to put on right now is that chlorinator, but it's 20 grand. And I've wanted to do it before we went to Cabo, but we spent so much. I don't have to have that because I have a system set up to flush it. The old-fashioned way, but I've taken other things in priority that need to be done and sort of let that, you know, that's not something that's going to keep the boat from going fishing. Other stuff is. So the problem is the sport's just getting really expensive. And it's not that in every sport. You know, look at NASCAR, look at him, it's just getting more and more expensive for people to stay in it. But the younger guys are just going to have to, really to maintain boats, that's the big ticket. Where you can keep the bills in hand.
Yeah.
Don't let things get out of hand.
I see so many boat owners just getting taken to the cleaners.
For 1 year, they're out.
Like
they're
that.
Out. The guy looks at it, look, I used this boat 20 days last year, and it cost me $2 million. This ain't worth it. Not including what he paid to buy it. You know, I spent all this money for crew, and then, he goes, this just isn't, I'm not enjoying it. Or then when we do catch, the thing breaks down because something was not taken care of, something like that. And then he gets his first trip for the year to wherever we're going, to Chubb Key, and then they spend the time when they're broken down. Why was it? This just isn't worth it. So the important thing is to try to keep the people that are really interested in the sport. And unfortunately, like Jim Sr., all that man wanted to do was fish. Don Tyson, these people, they want to do is fish. And we're losing a lot of the good people in the sport. So we've got to re-energize the sport with people. And we do have some new people come in that's what they want to do is fish. But you've got to keep them. You don't want to discourage them.
Right.
Don't want to discourage them. Don't want to burn them.
Yeah. No, not everybody's got to be an MTU or Detroit diesel mechanic and a captain. I mean, but, you know,
But it helps.
It helps. Or the basic knowledge.
Yeah. Yep.
Basic knowledge.
Yep.
The fuel goes in there, it comes out there. The air goes in there, the exhaust comes out. I mean, I've talked to some people that get a new brand new boat, and I said, oh, what kind of generators you got? I don't know. This is no time. What kind of propellers you got? I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure. I think we have Northern Lights, where they really had own ads. I'm like, Jesus Christmas. just built the boat. He says, well, I'm not, my job is just to run it. We have people to maintain it. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Outsourcing.
No, if that's the way it is, if you're fortunate to have a job like that, but if you don't want to, you know, you think you'd want to know your boat.
Right. You would think. You would think. Eddie, thank you so much.
Sure, no problem, guys. Thank you.
Enjoy, we really, really appreciate you coming out here and, you know, letting us come up here and rather do this. And I think this is going to be a good one.
Well, Eddie, it's just, it's getting harder and harder to find people that can go past the fish story. So by having guys like you, it's not a fish story. It's a life. It's a way of living. And that's what we call a real guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, all the guys that I've been with, have that they're in it, you know, Eric, his father, he grew up fishing from probably the day he came out of the womb. He's had a fishing rod in his hand. And, you know, there's another one. You know, he lives for fishing. You know, I know he's got a, you know, couple kids now, so he's trying to manage being a father and a fisherman, which he even told him, I've never had that problem. So I didn't have any kids. It was, I just had Labrador Retriever. So anyway, but it's, you know, it's tough. There's another problem. It's tough. When I first got to Cabo, when I drag into this thing, but, you know, my guys, it was tough. They had wives and family. It was tough for them being away. And that's a long ride to get home from Cabo. Mm-hmm. And I come home with my boss, no big deal. But when it's doing it the old-fashioned way, like all of the regular people have to do it, it's a difficult deal. But it's, they're like people like Eric, they've been brought up fishing. So now you're trying to manage being a father and a fisherman.
Yep. Right.
He's doing a damn good job of it, but it's difficult.
One of the things I take a lot of pride in is taking the kids fishing.
And he's doing a really good job of that.
I took Eric and his kid tarpon fishing up in the river, and to watch his kid's eyes get big, and you should see his brain working, and it's like, okay, maybe there is the new real guy out there. It's going to be kids like Eric's kid.
Yeah.
And anything I can do to keep the heritage alive and keep people fishing, I will do.
It's, you know, it's like everything else. It's an unbelievable sport. And we have to learn the management. You know, for example, you know, quick, years ago, remember the Lauderdale Bellfish Tournament?
Sure.
That fish was skipped that day, and he was running about 54 Bertram. It was back then it was a kill tournament. That particular day was unbelievable. It was one of these days that they come. I mean, and we've had, it's always like one or two days a year they really come. Like the day with the real tide, we caught 58 sailfish sitting off Boynton. I think we had 35, 80 bites sitting off Boynton Beach, 58. But that one particular day, next day we went out, it went to 20, next day they were gone.
Yep.
But that day they came, and remember we all came in, and there they are, 160 on polyp on the dock. Oh, come on. So then, you know, we've learned to manage our sport too. I mean, blue marlin-wise, I remember growing up, man, if you caught one 80 pounds or 800 pounds, he was going
to
come in.
He was coming to the
dock.
He
was coming in to go on that racket. Yeah. Now we've learned. You know, they even though they've put all these laws and regulations with size, I think even without that, people would have learned. The BBCs, when they were in effect, Jim Lambert was really one to push that into a full release tournament. We're just killing too much. And you got to remember, you kill a blue marlin, everybody wants the big one. You killed you don't need to kill them at all, but you're killing the wrong ones. You're killing the females.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, we killed a fish in Bermuda. They cut that thing open and had enough eggs in it to, you know, 40. I don't know what they told us. Biologists that was there. Of course, they were doing research, so that's a good thing. But, you know, you got to remember, you kill these big blue marlin, you kill the wrong ones.
Yeah.
Right.
We didn't kill any of them, but you're really killing the wrong ones when you kill that big female. But anyway, and maintaining our sport. You know, you got to look conservation, which is really big. And then, of course, keeping the owner, you know, interested in the sport.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't want to run out of the business, because even though they might have all the money they could possibly eat, but they get to the point where, oh, shit, man, I'm spending all this money and I'm having a miserable time. You get on the boat, the cruise, everybody's fighting or, you know, just that or it's like,
the clock's ticking on
that
one. I can
do better staying in the office and listen to all my employees complain at me. But he, you know, you want to keep your boss interested in the sport.
Yep. That's what happened with my father.
you know, he got tired of spending the money, and he just realized that it was easier to, you know, fly to Venezuela or go down to St. Thomas and, you know, fish with somebody else.
He did it all. I remember him at all the tournaments, all the shootouts, all the
stuff. Oh, he fished everything.
And,
yeah.
You know, and then he just got to the point, you know what?
He got burned out.
I'll just go charter.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
Let's go get out. If I go to wherever I want to go, I'll just go and have a good time. But anyway.
Hey. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sure, you're welcome, guys.
This is going to be a good one.
Phenomenal. Run that dog. So there you have it. A fishing legend. And people throw around the word legend way too much. There's only a few guys like Eddie in this world, and we were so glad to have him right here on the Real Guy Podcast.